Hello, I'm Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton, and I lead the Justice, Equity, and Opportunity Initiative. Welcome to my podcast series, Walk, Listen, Learn, Our Journey to Justice. Why a podcast? Well, I wanted to combine three things I love: walking, listening, and learning, as the title suggests. I'm also passionate about people and finding engaging ways to discuss issues. So thanks for joining me. Today in episode 3, we're talking about juvenile justice. And we're going to really dig into a conversation about adolescent brain development and its connection to young people, especially young people that end up in our juvenile justice system. And we'll also have a little bit of a chat about recently announced reforms to the Illinois Department of Juvenile Justice, for which my guest today has been a longtime advocate and proponent. My guest today is Julie Beal. She's the director of the Children and Family Justice Center at Northwestern University's Pritzker School of Law, and her work focuses on the representation of young people that are involved in the justice system and on policy reforms in the areas of juvenile sentencing, over-incarceration, and reentry. Welcome, Julie, and thanks for walking, listening, and learning with us.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So I've known you for a long time.
This is true.
And from the beginning of our work relationship and ultimately friendship, you have been one of the strongest and most powerful voices around reform efforts in this juvenile legal system, mostly because you work directly with young people that are entangled in this system. And I know that here in Illinois, a lot of people may not know, but we have really a unique history with the juvenile justice system and the juvenile court here. Can you talk just very briefly about sort of how this all started, that we have this separate system, a separate court system, really, for our young people? And then what else was created? Like, I know that there's the Department of Juvenile Justice here at the state level. In counties, we have juvenile detention centers. How did this all kind of come about?
Well, thank you first for having me, and we have been friends for a long time. I remember when you worked in the juvenile court. I consider myself a juvenile court lifer because the truth is I've been working in the child welfare or juvenile justice system for over 30 years.
Yeah.
Showing my age here today.
Well, some people don't know, I think, that are listening, that that was the first work I did right out of law school, was in the juvenile court system. At that time, we called it the child abuse and neglect side, which now it's considered the child protection side.
Right.
But I recognized very quickly how what was happening on that side was connected to the juvenile justice side.
For sure. I was one of my first clients who I represented when I was a public guardian, went over to the other side, and I was one of the only lawyers who went back in the day, we're now talking the 80s, who went over and represented him on the other side. I felt like that was important. But importantly, getting back to your question, yes, we are the home in Cook County of the first juvenile court. It was in 1899. We celebrated its 100th year anniversary a few years ago. And my recollection is it was started by the women of Hull House,
the Jane Adams,
and her friends, the wonderful women who started it. But what's interesting about its history is it started sort of as a paternalistic or maybe maternalistic approach to children, that they were to come in and we were to take care of them, that it wasn't going to be, there was actually a famous quote from the presiding judge, I think his name was Judge Mack back in the day, who talked about putting his arm around the young lad and taking care of him, and the judge coming off of his or her, I think it's probably only his back in the day,
mm-hmm.
Coming off of the bench,
yeah.
And sitting down next to the young lad. And we were, so it was a very sort of paternalistic approach.
It sounds more like these are young people that might need some support,
right.
Some care, some accompaniment to help them to continue on. That was kind of how it all started.
That's how it started. And I think then what happened was there was a recognition that the due process protections needed to be in place for these children. Because actually what was happening is an oftentimes, and progressively over time, their liberty interests were at stake. And when a person's, and when I say a liberty interest, mm-hmm. I mean that they were at risk of being removed from their home and going to detention or incarceration. And so what happened was the Supreme Court came in and they said, no, we can't just have this informal approach to the juvenile legal system. We have to have due process protections for children, much like we have for adults in the criminal sector.
So I just want to be clear. So it didn't even start really as an actual kind of court.
It was called a court, but it wasn't a court in the way that we think about courts these days.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't as adversarial.
One side on, yes, you know, trying to win.
Right. Well, not in that way.
A winner
and also
loser.
There wasn't the kind of due process protections that we hold dear.
Under the
Constitution.
Yeah.
So that change happened. I think you're talking about the Illinois Department of Juvenile Justice, and I remember actually, because I was involved in that, separation. And that was in 2006.
And Julie, I'm sorry, because I want to make sure that when you say that separation, it was a part of the Illinois Department
of Corrections.
So right. It was a part of the adult system.
Exactly.
And then became separated. I don't think a lot of people know that history either.
I don't think they do either. And I think it was a lot of advocates came in and said, wait a minute, why are we having children? We have a separate juvenile court. We have a separate juvenile court act. But yet, if a child becomes incarcerated, they're under the Illinois Department of Corrections.
Which is for everyone.
Yeah. It's for adults.
Whatever
for
age.
And that meant also that when they were released, they were under adult parole. It also meant that when they were revoked from parole, they had a violation of parole, and they went back in, they didn't have attorneys. So all these things, all the accoutrements that go along with being in an adult system were happening to the children, even though they were coming in as children, and
yeah,
even though they were being tried as children in a separate court system under a separate legal system, when they got to the prisons, it was just as if they were in adult prisons.
And I just want to make sure that I'm clear. What year was this?
2006.
So it wasn't that long ago.
No, it was very...
It was in the 2000s that we separated and had a Department of Juvenile Justice.
Right, 14 years ago.
That's
right.
Unbelievable. So I want to kind of pick up on that and talk a little bit more about adolescent brain development, because I know that probably back in 2006, if that research was happening, it was probably very early on. But since that time, we've had a lot of research, mm-hmm, about adolescent brain development that I know has been a big part of sort of the work around reforming this system. What do we know about the brains of young people, and why is that particularly important when we talk about juvenile justice reform?
I do think it was probably around that year that the neuroscientist came to the rescue and told us all what actually moms have known forever.
Right. We need the neuroscientists, we need the moms too.
We needed the neuroscientists to prove it to the Supreme Court, but the moms already knew it. And what the neuroscientists were able to prove through MRIs was that the prefrontal cortex, the front part of our brain, actually doesn't develop until we're 24. Right? And so what they were able to say, and that part of our brain is the control part of our brain. So what the neuroscientist said was the control part of your brain doesn't really fully develop until you're 24, but that social, emotional, wild person, teenage brain grows very quickly. And so you remember knucklehead teenagers, those crazy teen years.
I remember the teen years from my own, you know, I'm a mom as well.
Yeah.
But I hope more of us remember what it was like for us to be teens.
Exactly.
You know, we remember
our crazy
that.
Teen years.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I think what happens, and what the neuroscientists helped the juvenile legal system understand, is that so this control system, which let's just think of them as the brakes, right? And this emotional system, which is the gas, that it took a long time for the brakes to catch up with the gas.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you have is you have these teenagers who are impulsive.
Pressing the gas.
Doing
it regardless.
As one of my neighbors used to call when my kids were teenagers, they're heat-seeking missiles.
Yeah.
That was her line for them. And then, you know, they also, have you ever seen a teenager alone? I mean, they're always in groups. They're always in peer, because they're so influenced. The number one thing that they're influenced, which the scientists told us, although we knew this, is their peers.
Right. So
that's the most influential group. And they're also unable, and this is really important in terms of the juvenile court system, is they're unable to delay gratification, right? Mm-hmm. So all of these things combined create the adolescent brain, right, that we now better understand. There is great news, though, which we know, is that you grow out of it.
Yeah.
Right? Left alone, kids mature. They stop being heat-seeking missiles. Mm-hmm. They are able to make rational, good decisions. And this is what we know. And why it's important for decision makers, law enforcement, and for judges is that we now understand that juveniles in the juvenile court system are not little adults.
Right.
And this is fundamental, which is why we separated DJJ from DOC,
right,
which is why, you know, the Supreme Court has ruled in many, in five or six decisions, I think it's five, decisions over time, making a really important decision that children are categorically different than adults and therefore are categorically less culpable. And also the other great news is they're better able to be rehabilitated. Mm-hmm. So both of those principles, categorically less culpable and better able, great potential for rehabilitation, I think are like now the fundamental principles of a juvenile justice system.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, again, I mean, I don't want to just use the analogy of parenting, but you think about what you have to do with our young people as they are growing up, mm-hmm, and those sort of like that impulsivity and all of that, it starts pretty early,
yes,
and you start to see it happening. And as parents, you have to kind of figure out, okay, what kinds of things can we do, like, you know, some limitations, some boundaries, talking to, kind of getting people on track. And unfortunately, I think one of the things that we also see in our justice system is the racial disparities.
Well, yes.
And so the kind of like, let's just understand young people are different, doesn't get applied the same way.
Well, that is 100% true.
Yeah, so we end up seeing disparities where more black and brown children end up in this system, far disproportionately, and especially black children, especially black boys. And because there's less of that, oh, remember at this age, their brains are developing, and a little more, let's kind of move into this role of they need some sort of detention, incarceration, or punishment. Is that how this disparity is
happening? Totally true. And I think that we don't, as a society, understand that black boys are actually just black boys.
Yeah.
We adultify them. And going to your point, I think that currently in Illinois, you probably know the Illinois population better than I do, but the research that I saw said that black youth, not just boys, black youth take up 15% of Illinois' youth population.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, 70% of Illinois' Department of Juvenile Justice are black children.
Yeah.
So that right there, to me, that data piece alone speaks volumes about how differently we treat black children from white children.
Well, I certainly want to talk about
that.
I want to
talk about that all day.
Yeah, well, and we're going to provide some more resources for people to read up on these issues that we're talking about. But I think it ties directly into what we're talking about with why Governor Pritzker and I, along with the Department of Juvenile Justice, recently announced some reforms, what we're calling the 21st Century Illinois Transformation Model, which is a series of reforms to our juvenile justice system here in Illinois. There was a time, and I know you've worked throughout the history of this system, this Department of Juvenile Justice, where we had hundreds of young people in the system, and now because of advocacy from you and others who have been working with you and advocates around the state, that number is now, and policy changes, I should also say, and legislative changes from members of the General Assembly, that number is now closer to 100. It's a big drop.
A tremendous success.
Yeah, lots of work that's been done. And so we recently announced these series of reforms through the 21st Century Illinois Transformation Model. And it's really to address some of the issues that you talked about, like recognizing the difference in adolescent brain development, recognizing the racial disparities we see in this system, and really transitioning these sort of big prison-like structures that are based around the state to smaller, more regional residential centers, that are more therapeutic and really provide more community wraparound supports and services, as well as services for victim services that are based in communities that are often disproportionately impacted, not just by violence, but by mass incarceration, historic disinvestment, and all the other things that we know that happens in these communities. So I thought I could start by, because we talked of sort of like the broader picture about why the system is different, why the brain development looks so different and why it's important. But what have you heard, I mean, directly from young people? You've worked directly with young people that have been justice involved. What have they told you about some of the challenges that exist in this system?
Well, that's a great question, and I have worked with them for many years. And I want to just, before I answer that question, I want to just say that I remember in 2006 when we were convincing people to separate the model, there was a push against us because at that time there were 1,700 children in the what they called the juvenile division of the Illinois Department of Corrections. And the person who was the director at that time had produced modeling of what he projected was going to happen. And instead of what we were projecting, which was it was going to go down and all the changes we wanted and how I'm very proud to say over the 14 years we've been working on
have
it,
happened.
It went down from 1,700 to 100.
That's
and thank
amazing.
You for helping us with those changes. And there have been a lot. We thought about it, or the way I conceptualize it is we closed the front door, we closed the back door, and we closed the revolving door. But his model was that we were going to have 2,500 children within the next 3 years, and we had to build six more prisons instead of closing prisons. So it was a great turnaround. And I think that that sort of sets the stage for what the children have told us, right? So what we did at the Children Family Justice Center over the last 2 years is I decided we do a huge amount of research, as you know, and we have put out a lot of reports on the Department of Juvenile Justice and other things over the years. But what I thought was missing was the young people's voices. And so what we did 2 years ago is we decided to have convenings. And we sat down with over 550 youth across the state. I know it's a huge, it took us a long time, which that's why I said it took 2 years.
And were all of them justice involved or no?
No, I'm going to tell you who they are.
Okay.
So a group of them were in the nine, so what we did is we looked at the nine counties that committed the most children to DJJ. And we went to those communities. We oversampled in Cook County.
Okay.
Because Cook County has the highest number. And then we did all the children inside of DJJ. So we did two different huge groups. One we called the community convenings, and one we're calling the inside convenings. Not every one of the youth on the community convenings had been actually incarcerated, but many of them had been detained in their local detention centers, and many of them had been arrested, and many of them had been, if they hadn't been arrested or detained or incarcerated, then family members who were. And so they were from these communities that were most hardest hit by incarceration.
I know you're going to share specifically a couple of things that some young people have said, but I want to make sure detention, when you say some were detained and others were incarcerated, a lot of people think detention is the same as incarceration.
You are so right.
What is juvenile detention?
That is such a good question, and I should have explained it.
No, so, I think it's something that when we do this work, like both of us do, you say it and then
speak, right. So detention is pre your finding of guilt. So like, I think people understand it better in the jail context,
right?
In the adult context. So we understand that when you get arrested as an adult, you go to jail while you're waiting for your trial. And we're not talking about cash bail today, but that's a totally different racial discriminatory issue, but we're not talking about. But and we don't have money bond in juvenile court. So let's just be clear.
Yeah, but they are detained.
They are detained.
While awaiting.
Many children are detained. A judge has to make a determination that it is unsafe for the community and the child, for that child, or that there's a risk that the child is going to flee while the trial is pending, then a child is detained pending the trial.
And then after detention, if there is a finding of
guilt,
then that young person can be then transferred to Department of Juvenile Justice.
Yeah. Hopefully not, because it's in the Juvenile Court Act, as you well know, the being committed to the Department of Juvenile Justice is the last resort.
That's right.
We are always looking for other options for children.
So tell me more about what some of the young people said.
So in August, so I guess that was last month, it's hard to remember time in the time of COVID, we released the Community Convenings Reimagining Investments in Illinois Youth Report, which really sets forth what the community convening said. And then forthcoming, we just finished this week. And what's interesting is a formerly incarcerated young man led the convenings inside the prison.
Powerful.
It was very powerful. And he wrote a reflection, and the beginning of the report is going to be his reflection about what it felt like to walk back in as a freed person after having spent 4 years in the Department of Juvenile Justice, going back in and leading these conversations with the young men, boys, that he was with.
Yeah.
It's a very powerful document that I will be happy to share with you. And it will come out in our report. But I think that what you've asked me is, what did the children say? And what a lot of them said to us, and this is not a direct quote, but what they said to us is that they felt like no one asked them why. Why did you do what you did?
Mm-hmm.
And second, not the police when they were arresting him, not the judge, not anyone. Why and what do you need?
Yeah.
That they don't ask them those fundamental questions. And they also, this other thing, I do have a quote from it, which just broke my heart, which this young man said, "No one invested in me until I committed a crime."
Mm.
And that just broke my heart. He said, "Until I shot somebody, no one spent a dime on me." And I just found like that's so profound. It goes to your point earlier about disinvestment in communities. You know, here is a direct quote. I mean, I think what they were really saying is our communities are poor. We come from poor communities where there's a complete deprivation of resources and opportunities. So one young man said, so you go to the South Side and there's nothing. You have to tiptoe around even to find somewhere that you can go to the bathroom, let alone a place where a kid can go when they get out of school. All they know is what's around them, death and gangs and violence, gun violence. I also think we have to make sure that every single neighborhood, every environment has resources that really allow young people to thrive, whether there's parks or programs, after school programs, healthcare services, making sure that every kid has access to all these things and that they're the same in all the neighborhoods in our state, which goes to your point about different neighborhoods having lots of things and some neighborhoods having nothing.
And seeing that through a young person's
eyes,
you know, that why don't I have what that other community has?
Right.
And adding on top of that, just to kind of tie a bow on all of this, is with your brain still developing.
Right.
It's not an adult brain that says, well, let me look at trends and the history and policy making.
No.
It's just a kid's brain who's thinking, I don't get why they have it and I don't,
exactly.
But I want it.
I want it, and why can't I have it? The other theme was that they felt like the overarching system was just purely punishment and punitive to them. And when they talked about, so that's what a lot of the sort of the themes. For the young people, and these are direct quotes from the young people. This is from the report that's forthcoming. So these are from quotes from the children that are incarcerated. So they were saying just generally that they felt like it was violent and boring and punitive. But one child said, people get beat up here every day. We can't even get clean because there's mold dropping on us and mites crawling in your bed. Plus there are these crazy geese outside of the building. We wake up in the morning and have bad food, but at least we don't have lice here anymore, so that's a good thing. The next kid said, well, there's no privacy and we're under constant surveillance and they keep the lights on and they never turn them off. Every day is the same and there's nothing to do but stare at the walls. Programming, ha, we sit in the units all day. Detention setting is just like daycare with barbed wire.
Yeah, and I wanna kinda like, that's a perfect statement to talk about why these changes were made, are being made. Because this thought of this large system with barbed wire, and I think you'll probably talk about this a little bit, about away from miles and miles away, hundreds of miles perhaps, away from your family and your community and the support of your family, is why we really had to move, had made this announcement that we're moving to this model of sort of smaller, more therapeutic, close to home, dorm-like facilities that are based in communities where young people are most likely being committed to the Department of Juvenile Justice. Why is that so important? Based on what you heard from young people,
yeah, why is that?
And some of those examples you gave, why is that so critical that we start to think about them coming closer to home?
Well, I think an important thing to think about, because we've talked about them being prisons, we've talked about them being, the children stay in cells, the children, there's barbed wire, and they don't get to see their families. I think this is an interesting data point in one of our reports. We looked at the data about family visits, because I think that connection to family is critically important. And in the report that we wrote on family visits, we saw that in 2019, so it's just last year, so I don't think it's probably changed much, probably less because of COVID, but you can't really look at that. On average, a child that's incarcerated in Illinois gets a visit from any family member once every 35 days. That, if you can just think about being 15 years old and being scared and being in a cell and getting to see a family member once every 35 days, I think that speaks volumes.
And that's when you need to see your family.
The most.
Yeah.
Right. The other thing we know about these large adult-like prisons is that they're basically ineffective, mm-hmm. right? They're ineffective at what? At advancing public safety, which is what we all want. They're prohibitively expensive. I mean, they cost so much money.
Yeah.
I just think you're going to save a ton of money. And I also think no matter how hard the administration works, and I applaud the administration and I applaud the executive staff of DJJ, they are killing themselves to do the best that they possibly can do. There's no question about it. And I would be critical, as you know, if I needed to be. And I have nothing critical to say. But it's simply impossible, this is the point, to rehabilitate children in that environment.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a fundamentally flawed place for rehabilitation. And I want to say something else, and I think this is what you're getting at by this new model, which is, I think the truth of the matter is that we have to look at whether it's the child that really needs rehabilitation.
Hmm.
Because if a child was in a different environment, in a community that had resources, would that child commit the crime that he or she did?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the question that we all have to grapple with, because we're so focused on this Tommy, Johnny, needs to be fixed. Well, I'm not sure that's, I mean,
yeah.
Sure, Tommy or Johnny did something wrong. Okay, I'm granting them that. But why? Mm-hmm. Why did they do it wrong? One of the kids said to us, I did wrong because there's no food on the table. I needed to go get, I joined the gang. Yes, I did join the gang because my family was poor and they had no money and it was the way, only way I could see to get food on the table.
It's that you posed a similar question as you were quoting one of the young people.
Mm.
I often talk about and talked about in a previous episode, a young person who said to me, you all always ask us, what did you do? But you don't ask us, what do we need?
Right.
And I think that when you're talking about community investment, so just in closing, I want to talk just very briefly about just sort of thinking about what can happen in communities. In light of the brain development needs, in light of the fact that many of these communities have suffered decades of disinvestment, we're putting a lot of money currently into the juvenile justice system. What can happen with these smaller, more therapeutic facilities that are based in community? What can we do to invest in the communities that would be helpful for these young people?
Well, I think that the important thing is to have services in those communities, right? That's fundamental.
Right.
You and I agree about that, and I think you've done it in other ways with R3, I think,
mm-hmm.
is doing it, and I think that that's fundamental. I think that what we heard from the young people is about, or we're saying services, and I think what's better in the community is they can be trauma-informed instead of inflicting trauma, okay? They can be nuanced. They can be individualized. They can be creative. The kids kept saying, well, they can be creative. They can be social. We talked about children, these teenagers doing better when they're with their peers. They can be social. They can also, you're an RJ person, restorative justice person from way back when, they can be more restorative
mm-hmm.
because you can talk about healing the harm, right? And I think all of those things really go to growing the community. I also think they're not going to be removed from education, which is incredibly important. And I haven't seen the peer review literature on this, but after 30 years of representing young people, I can tell you from my experience that a child who gets a high school diploma is 10, 100 times more likely to be successful. Now, we need the sociologists or some researchers to tell us.
There's research out about what happens when we talk about, you know, educational attainment and what that does for economic.
Yes, I'm sure of it. I'm confident. I haven't read it, but I'm confident. I've seen it with my own eyes.
Sure.
But I also think we've talked about the deprivation in these communities. I think that if you put services into communities, they're going to be cost effective, they're going to enhance public safety, and there's going to be this, I was also thinking about this, there's another unintended larger societal benefit, right? Which is you may be preventing future problems. Hmm. Because if the communities that you're going to be investing in are the communities where these children come from, and they've been historically deprived, and yet we invest in them, then there's a chance that they will not have the need to be knuckleheads and commit crimes in the future. Yeah. I will say one other thing.
And I just want to say, and I know you have one more thing, but I think about that ties again to, I'm trying to make the connection to the adolescent brain development.
Yes, totally.
Let's get them to 25.
Yeah, let's get them to 25.
Like,
that's all we need.
Let's get them to 25.
That's all we need. We need to, because, you know, the research, this is old research by, now I'm going to forget his name, out of Pennsylvania, that talks about desistance. You know, that if you just get them, they're going to desist. Just keep them safe and they're going to desist.
Yeah.
I think that the other thing that I know about we'll see the plan and I'm excited about the plan, but I think we have to be careful. We don't want them to be like just smaller prisons. We want to be really clear that they're not that. Because one of the things that you said that resonated with the young people that I work with and with me about that at the model, when you were announcing your model, was what these young people need is love and support and understanding. Yeah. And I think that is the theme. When you listen to the young people in all of our meetings with them and we know what we know, that's what they need.
Yeah.
You know, love, support, understanding. Why? What do you need? Those are pretty...
Love, support, and understanding. I think that's a great way to close out, because who doesn't need that? Who has ever grown up without needing love, support, and understanding? We certainly have.
We have.
Julie, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure, Lieutenant Governor.
Thank you for your passion. Thank you for your knowledge, your advocacy. But mostly, I, too, want to thank you for loving our young people.
I do.
Please don't forget to continue to walk, listen, and learn with us. I'm really grateful that you're with us. And keep up the great work. I look forward to continuing our work together.
Me, too. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. That's it for this episode of Walk, Listen, Learn, Our Journey to Justice. Until next time, I'm Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton. Thank you for walking, listening, and learning with me. Let's stay on this path towards justice, equity, and opportunity for all.